Hello, thank you for joining our CMS Lessons from the Frontlines on COVID-19 today, May 15th. We'd like to begin by thanking all of you for the work that you are doing day in and day out to care for patients and their families around the nation amidst COVID-19. This is Alina Chekai, leading stakeholder engagement in the Office of CMS Administrator Seema Verma. And as I mentioned, today's call is part of our ongoing weekly series, Lessons from the Frontlines. And while members of the press are always welcome to attend these calls, we do ask that they please refrain from asking questions. All press and media questions can be submitted using our online media inquiries form, which can be found at cms.gov/newsroom. Any non-media COVID-19 related questions for CMS can be directed to our email box, which is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. Here at CMS, we recognize that government's role during COVID-19 is to offer maximum flexibility and regulatory relief to allow you all to do what you do best, care for the patients in your local communities. Around the nation, providers and local communities are innovating in response to COVID-19. At CMS, we hope to bring local innovators together to share best practices that can be scaled at the national level. And today's call will focus on these expanded flexibilities, and we will hear from providers who are seizing the opportunity to really innovate and transform to support their local communities. Today, we will hear from providers who are in the midst of reopening the healthcare system and resuming care that might have been deferred during the pandemic. We'll also hear some best practices for post-acute care, long-term care, and successful transitions of care, as well as solutions for provider resiliency and support during these challenging times. And we do encourage you to direct your questions to our guest speakers today, and you're also welcome to share best practices or perspectives from your own community. And should you have more technical questions on CMS waivers and guidance, we do encourage you to join our CMS office hours, which are held every Tuesday and Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern. This week, we are joined by Dr. Satish Pillai, who is leading the Healthcare Resiliency Task Force, for an update from the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, also known as ASPR. Dr. Pillai, over to you.
Thank you so much, Alina, for the opportunity, and thank you for all the participants for joining. Just as a brief reminder for those of you who have previously attended, the Healthcare Resilience Task Force in the National Response Coordination Center at FEMA has the objectives to ensure that providers and healthcare systems have what they need to effectively manage the health system surge from COVID-19 and to provide care to priority COVID and non-COVID-19 patients. The task force has been engaged on a variety of topics to deliver against our objectives. For example, we recently released guidance on medical operation coordination cells, or MOCs. This guidance recognizes that some hospitals have been overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients, while other nearby hospitals have excess capacity. The MOCs are designed to facilitate the transfer of patients between facilities to ensure patients receive the highest possible level of care and to better load balance demands across the health system. The MOC guidance is currently available on ASPR Tracy. In addition, recognizing the risk and vulnerability among residents of nursing homes, the task force has been tracking and supporting work, including coordination with CDC and CMS, on leveraging CDC's National Healthcare Safety Network to set up reporting modules for states. Of 15,000 nursing homes in the country, 12,000 are now registered, and over 6,700 nursing homes have reported data. Also, this team is conducting a federally supported nursing home testing pilot across multiple states in multiple facilities across four states to better understand optimal ways to address the risk of COVID-19 infections in the nursing home setting. Regarding another high-risk patient population, dialysis patients, we have partnered with ASPR to deploy dialysis resources to hotspots, including 50 dialysis machines that have been deployed from the Strategic National Stockpile to New York, and we've helped facilitate the import of dialysate solution. Another area of increasing focus is rural health. Recognizing rural hospitals represent over half of all hospitals in the U.S., and provide access to inpatient, outpatient, and emergency medical services to rural communities, it's important to note that they have unique challenges related to their geography and vulnerable populations. And because of these unique challenges, the task force is working on a rural health surge proposal to prepare for a potential second wave of COVID-19, partnering with across the Health and Human Services Department, including groups from CMS, CDC, HRSA, and the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. Another important area for our task force has been clinician outreach. Working with ASPR staff and the University of New Mexico, we have leveraged Project ECHO to facilitate peer-to-peer learning sessions between physicians to share COVID-19 best practices and clinical guidance. Between March 24th and May 14th, we've had 23 sessions that have hosted 17,900 live participants engaging in peer-to-peer sessions on topics ranging from EMS, critical care, emergency department care, and special topics such as PPE preservation. And through our CDC partnerships, there have been over 1,100 views during the agency's clinician outreach communication activity, or COCA calls, which provide the state of the art on a variety of clinical COVID-19 topics. And there have been over 1.5 million web page hits on CDC recommendations on a variety of clinical guidance and clinical evaluation material. Finally, we are currently in the process within the task force thinking about the needs of the healthcare system in the coming months as the pandemic evolves. As we plan to sustain ongoing federal operations, we are looking to continue a set of activities to support the healthcare system, including remote delivery of help, such as through telemedicine services, providing vulnerable populations with optimal care services, and ensuring critical care access for rural populations. With that, I'll stop and turn it back to the moderator. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pillai. Really appreciate hearing your perspective and updates from the task force. Operator, let's open up the lines for some questions for Dr. Pillai. Thank you.
Certainly. And just to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from Lydia Aguinaldo from Find Home Healthcare. Your line is open.
Yes, doctor. I just want to know if when can an employee come back to work a COVID positive?
So my recommendations right now would be to refer back to the CDC website. There are updated guidances on optimal timing of return to work for healthcare providers. Some employ a test-based strategy, and some employ a time-based strategy. And the optimal guidance for any particular agency would be, you know, based on their current staffing situation, guidance from their local health department, and their human resources policies. But the most up-to-date guidance for the healthcare providers can be found on CDC's healthcare provider website. Over.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Hi there. We can hear you. What is your question, please? Operator, we'll take our next question, please.
We have no further questions at this moment, ma'am. You may continue.
Great. Thanks again, Dr. Pillai, for joining us today. We'd now like to hear from physician leaders around the country about what they're facing in their local communities and the strategies that are working for them as we address the pandemic. And today we are joined by physician leaders from around the country who have offered to share their insights and best practices. Our speakers today will discuss reopening the healthcare system, specifically perspectives from oncology and primary care, long-term care, as well as resiliency support for providers during these times. And also joining me from CMS are several of our physician leaders who will offer their expert perspectives throughout the conversation as well. Joining me today is Dr. Marion Couch, Senior Medical Advisor to Administrator Seema Verma, Dr. Sherry Ling, Acting Chief Medical Officer at CMS, Dr. Michelle Schreiber, Director of the Quality Measurement and Value-Based Incentives Group at the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality at CMS, and Dr. Barry Marks, Director of the Office of Clinical Engagement. And we'll start today's best practices session with a discussion on resuming deferred care. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Stephen Labuti, Director of the Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey. Dr. Labuti, over to you.
Thanks, Alina, and thanks for inviting me to participate today. So as Alina said, I serve as director of the Rutgers Cancer Institute in New Jersey. We're New Jersey's only National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer center. And as the designated cancer center by the NCI for the state, have done our best to play a role in helping the cancer programs throughout New Jersey to discuss and put in place best practices. We've engaged with 12 other statewide cancer programs throughout New Jersey, and we meet by WebEx once a week to discuss mutual challenges, ways that we are approaching things like personal protective equipment, scheduling patients for acute care needs, whether that's medical oncology, surgical oncology, or radiation oncology needs, and discussing ways in which we could be best prepared to handle the various waves or surges of the pandemic, given the fact that cancer patients are a particularly vulnerable population, both for their risk of contracting SARS-CoV-2 and their morbidity if they develop COVID-19. The cancer programs throughout New Jersey never stopped providing cancer care. We've been providing infusions to patients on active chemotherapy regimens, radiation therapy, and urgent cancer surgery throughout the pandemic. However, we did significantly leverage telemedicine for certain less acute visits, and this was incredibly important to maintain care and contact with our patients. And so we are grateful to CMS and others for allowing telemedicine to be implemented on a much larger scale. And we believe telemedicine is here to stay, certainly for the management of cancer patients. However, now as we try to get back to a more in-person posture, we have established screening programs for our patients and our staff. This involves contacting patients ahead of time to do symptom checks and to determine whether or not there may be a situation where a patient is manifesting symptoms of COVID before an appointment. We do temperature and history screening at the door of the cancer center for patients and staff. And we've now not only begun testing all symptomatic patients, but we were also testing asymptomatic patients that meet certain criteria, patients about to start chemotherapy, about to start radiation therapy, or planned surgical resections for their cancer. We're also opening up surgical oncology more broadly and cancer screening. Modalities such as mammography and endoscopy in order to catch up with what we believe have been deferred cancer screening by many patients. We're also working with some of the payers in our region evaluating approaches to things like home chemotherapy infusion so we can be best prepared for future waves of the pandemic if they present themselves. And so that's been our approach to enhance communication among all the cancer programs throughout the state. So we're sharing experiences and best practices to provide a means of screening our patients and our providers so we can maintain the best level of care possible. And now we're on a posture where we're trying to open up more cancer screening, cancer surgery, and in-person visits to get back on a more usual posture on for the best care for our patients. And so I'm happy to stop there for any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Labuti. We'll now turn it over to Dr. James Rice of Annapolis Pediatrics, and then we'll open up to questions after Dr. Rice's presentation. Dr. Rice, over to you.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Alina, and thanks for the opportunity to present a perspective from primary care pediatrics. My name is Jim Rice. I'm a pediatrician at Annapolis Pediatrics, which is an independent general pediatrics practice in Maryland, fairly large with 30 providers, five office locations. We serve 37,000 patients, and 6,000 of those patients are covered by Medicaid. I want to focus my comments as a pediatrician on vaccination. We may not yet have a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, but we do have safe and effective vaccines against other deadly diseases. So, you know, for my fellow pediatricians and for me, a terrible aftershock of this pandemic would be to see outbreaks of pertussis, measles, or other vaccine-preventable diseases such as infant meningitis. So, unfortunately, though, pediatric vaccination rates have dropped substantially since March 13th. CDC data shows declines in ordering and administration of vaccines by 50% or more nationally. You know, in my practice, our experience, our vaccination rates for the month of April of this year are down 40% overall from our baseline. But throughout the pandemic, following the American Academy of Pediatrics guidance, we've focused on vaccinating the less than two-year-old age group, where timing of vaccines is the most critical. So in that age group, we've kept rates in at 85 to 90% of normal. On the other hand, adolescent vaccination is way down and really did not occur at all through April and the first half of May in our practice. Like most practices around the country in primary care, in mid-March, our overall in-person visit volume dropped to 20% of normal. We quickly mobilized telemedicine and greatly appreciate the flexibility from CMS and from payers to use that. We've temporarily closed two of our five offices, and we designated one office as the single location to provide vaccines and well baby care for symptom-free patients accompanied by one parent wearing a mask. Our staff wears PPE. And then patients of any age who are symptomatic in any way, fever or otherwise, are screened with a telemedicine visit, and if appropriate, are then evaluated in person in a different office. Telemedicine we've also used extensively for behavioral health, for other amenable medical conditions, and for non-vaccine-related well child care with anticipatory guidance. It's been effective for that. But as far as keeping the vaccine rates up in young kids, the separation of symptomatic versus well patients by office location has helped decrease parental resistance to in-person care. However, we definitely still encounter some degree of parental reluctance to come into the office with their infants, in particular for vaccines. We are, as pediatricians, concerned about asymptomatic shedding in children of COVID-19, and we did have one of our physicians become ill with COVID-19 in mid-March prior to more universal use of PPE in the office in primary care. So PPE is now critical. This physician's doing fine, by the way. So we have not vaccinated older children or adolescents during the period when Maryland limited non-essential care. And this will now be a priority of our efforts in reopening everything in the practice. You know, deferring adolescent vaccines for 8 weeks is recoverable, but, you know, the summer is when we really catch a lot of these adolescents. And so we really want to recover those rates for meningococcal, HPV, and tetanus pertussis vaccines. You know, sustainability of our ability to continue to vaccinate is a huge concern. Financial strain on pediatric practices, particularly independent ones that serve so many kids in our country, is really considerable. You know, revenue's down considerably, and pediatric practices are normally run on a very high fixed overhead and very low margins. So it's we don't have much reserve. It's been tough. So we've furloughed staff, and you know, and to date nationally, pediatricians have not been eligible for stimulus funds dispersed to Medicare providers. So really haven't gotten that source of funding. Our practice in particular was fortunate to receive a PPP loan funding, which has allowed us to continue to function for the short term. But, you know, beyond that, as an independent practice, and, you know, from hearing so many of my pediatric colleagues around the country, we depend upon, day-to-day, week-to-week revenue to operate. It will be a challenge to continue to provide pediatric care and vaccines, especially as we reopen. Efficiency will really be strained by new workflows, by use of PPE, by separating patients. I think we'll want to try to continue to separate healthy and symptomatic. And so volume and revenue are not likely to rebound quickly. So it's going to be a challenge. You know, we're committed to remaining viable, and like so many pediatricians around the country, and try to continue vaccinating. And, you know, we hope to be able to give the COVID-19 vaccine to children in our practice as well. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wright. And before we open it up to questions from the lines, I'd like to invite my CMS colleagues to ask any questions or make any comments before we open it up to live Q&A. Thank you.
Hi, this is Barry Marks from the Office of Clinician Engagement, and wonderful presentations. And Dr. Rice, I have a question for you. You mentioned performing well child visits virtually, and you mentioned specifically anticipatory guidance, but I'm just wondering, has there been experience within your practice around the parents' engagement with things like developmental screening and other risk assessments that are normally done as part of the scheduled routine well-infant, well-child, and well-adolescent visits?
Yes, thanks for that question. There has been engagement around that. We have for years now performed standardized developmental screening in the office using the ages and stages questionnaire and the MCHAT. We've done those on paper and then had to enter those into our EMR. Other practices have gotten the technology where they're actually have an electronic portal to enter those, and I think those practices were in sort of better shape to be nimble with that via telemed. We quickly sort of posted those screens on our website, and we even had a couple of our used some of our nurses and medical assistants to kind of go through the screen verbally with parents and fill that out. I think the added value is, as pediatricians, we realize we are actually, with telemedicine, getting to observe kids at home, and sometimes in addition to the developmental screening, the standardized tools, that additional observation of kids in an environment they're comfortable with has opened up some new windows for us into observing development and parent-child interaction that I think has been helpful.
Thank you very much.
So, hi, and this is Michelle Schreiber from the Quality Measures and Value-Based Incentives Group. First of all, to both of our presenters, thank you for being here today, and thank you for your innovations. And to all of you on the phone, thank you for being the heroes of the front line fighting this pandemic. I have a question for both of you. We hear from patients frequently that they're afraid to go into the office and they're afraid to restart care. What is it that you're doing in your practices to help reassure patients, even having patients waiting in the car before they come in, or any outreach that you're doing to make patients feel more comfortable?
So I can start the answer. This is Steve Labuti, and then let Dr. Rice give his thoughts as well. So one of the things we felt is important is for our patients to feel a sense of security that we are being vigilant on identifying infectious risk for them as best as we can. Obviously, cancer population is a particularly vulnerable population to the morbidity of COVID-19. And so screening patients ahead of time, 24 hours before their visit, minimizing the number of patients that are in a waiting area, so maximizing social distancing. We decreased the number of folks that can accompany patients to their visit, which as a cancer provider, and I'm sure this is true for Dr. Rice as a pediatrician, that was really counter to our culture. We look to provide the best support network possible, and that often involves friends and family coming with patients for visits or treatment. But we had to scale back on that quite a bit to maximize social distancing. And now our rigorous efforts to test patients, asymptomatic or symptomatic, And we have special areas within the Cancer Institute where if a patient is positive and does need to proceed with treatment, we are keeping patients who are positive and patients who are negative separated in order to decrease the risk of spread. So I think a lot of it is, and then obviously our staff uses PPE and our patients are all wearing masks when they're in the facility. And so it's been the ability to communicate to patients that we are cleaning rooms frequently, we are masking and using social distancing, and we're testing to try to minimize the chances of picking up an infection by coming into what is usually considered a safe place for them to receive their care.
Great. Yeah, I think our approach has been similar. We actually just today posted a video on our website for our patients, and we actually emailed it out to patients. It's, if anyone wants to take a look, it's on our Annapolis Pediatrics website. And it shows the new process in the office to patients, and we thought just showing that directly by video might be helpful, involving social distancing in the office. We're really trying to get away from the waiting room. No one likes the waiting room anyway, but we are asking patients to call or text from the car, and we'll sort of escort them into the office and really sort of in and out without the waiting room. I think that'll be key to our workflows. It does, you know, it'll be the right thing to do medically. I think from a viability standpoint, it's concerning in that, like I said, we run, you know, really very high volume operations. We've traditionally run a walk-in clinic to provide frictionless access for patients and an all-day walk-in service even. I don't think we'll be able to do that. We need to be able to plan and manage flow a little bit better. So it will change some things substantially in pediatrics.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much. Operator, let's open up the lines for questions from the phone. Thank you.
Certainly, ma'am. As a reminder to everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, to ask a question or make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from Lydia Aguinaldo of Fines Home Healthcare. Your line is open. Moving on to the next question, we have from Gif Asset of IHP. Your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, hello? I can. What is your question?
Yes. We had a question regarding, you know, whenever a practice applies to be in network with a health insurance company, they say that they take, they're allowed 120 days, and sometimes it can take 6 months. So with the current situation, can there be anything in place such that we are able to see patients that are considered out of network, or if there is a way to speed up the process for being in network for a health insurance so that we can help patients that are requesting for help?
Thank you for your question. I don't think we have the right CMS technical experts on the phone to address that question, but I'm happy to take that one back as a follow-up. I've recorded your contact information from the operator queue, so to speak, so I'm happy to follow up with you on that one.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear who's speaking.
Sure. This is Alina Chekai at CMS.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take our next question, please.
Again, for everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no further questions, ma'am. You may continue.
Terrific. Thank you. And thanks again to Dr. Labuti and Dr. Rice for joining us and sharing your perspective. Our next segment today will discuss caring for post-acute patients and transitions of care during COVID-19. And today's speaker is Dr. Dheeraj Mahajan. He is the president and CEO at the Chicago Internal Medicine Practice and Research. Dr. Mahajan, over to you.
Thank you, Alina. Good morning and good afternoon, everybody, based on where you are. My name is Raj Mahajan. I'm here in Chicago. I'm an internist and geriatrician, and I'm also a present CEO of SIMPAR, which is a group practice of 15 physicians and 8 advanced practice clinicians. We do cover hospitals, but our specialty is transitional care and nursing home care. And the niche we have developed here is several years ago, we moved away from the traditional fee-for-service medicine to go directly to either payers or health systems and ACOs to give them their post-acute coverage on a performance and risk-based contract. And we are able to do that with providing them the performance not only on clinical as well as on the resource use side. First of all, I would like to thank Administrator Verma and her team for so quickly coming up with things and plans to save us. It's a private practice that I own, and as you can say, we have 20-plus providers that get paid every 2 weeks, and during early piece part of April, I just didn't know how we were going to make our payroll. And like a lot of my other friends, the surprise we received on April 10th, that Friday, woke up to the bank account having miraculously had enough funds to make the payroll the following Wednesday. I have not been that happy since my 11-year-old daughter was born back in June of 2008. So thank you so much for that. We were able to get our advance payment also, as well as the payroll protection loan, which has really helped us just be able to have payroll for our employees. Imagine being on the front line and putting everything at risk and not be able to be paid, and that's not, and it's very thankful for that. I personally, I'm a medical director at 3 CCRC, the Continued Care Retirement Communities, and personally have spent a lot of time volunteering to advance the quality and reduce the disparity that we have within the post-acute space. I have been on several CMS and National Quality Forum technical expert panels addressing the quality in and other physician-related value-based programs, and I worked with CDC as well as local health department on the technical expert panels for post-acute related matters. I definitely want to thank AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute Long-Term Care Medicine. That is the group where all of our practitioners come together. They have worked tirelessly to give direction to all the common concerns we have, from medication treatment, isolation guidelines, physician practice. It's been very helpful, and so is the groups like Advancing Excellence in America's Nursing Homes. Is a loose group of quality improvement experts and stakeholders that come together. I personally have worked on infection control and interoperability and have been fighting for meaningful electronic health technology in post-long-term care, which we all know has a lot of opportunity. I am amazed every day by the selfless and courageous attitude all my clinicians have shown during this worst crisis of our lifetime. And I know it's cliche, but most of them have decided to run towards the fire instead of running away from. Early on, we heard people really just not wanting to be around an outbreak facilities, but But our practitioners on an average are spending 12 to 14 hours every day on site, and that sum is by design. Because these are advanced practitioners that we have put on site, and they've been the only practitioners in the facility. Currently, all three facilities that I have as a medical director are at different stages of outbreak. The facility that had its first case is officially COVID-free as of yesterday. I'm so proud to say that. The second facility is at the peak of its outbreak. It has 25 active cases and so far three deaths, and it's been fighting a lot of media negativity, and that's a challenge as physicians and clinical leaders. And then the third facility, which for years I've proudly bragged at a lot of national avenues as the best facility that has infection control program throughout the country, if not the best, definitely among the best, had just first two cases last week, and just this week we found we have four more. We're doing everything to do our infection control related precautions. And most of these facilities have assisted living or other independent living within the campus, and it is very, very difficult to control the flow of visitors and residents in that setting. Very early on, before we had a first nursing home case in Illinois, we were able to institute visitor restriction, address goals of care for all our residents, and thanks to AMD again for giving that guidance. We did our daily PPE inventory. We did a massive staff education on hand hygiene, social distancing, enhanced infection control practices. We definitely made sure we included all our non-clinical staff, because nurses and CNAs a lot of times do get regular in-services on basics of hand hygiene and social distancing, et cetera. But we made sure we had our environmental services and nutritional services staff included on these educations. We were lucky that most of our residents and families were supportive of our visitor restriction. And in coming weeks, we did institute practitioner restrictions, especially after the data from Kirkland facility showed that a lot of these initial outbreaks were related to asymptomatic staff going in between different facilities. So we were very strict on our registry and agency staff as to places they were going. The screening were put in place very, very early on. As the telehealth visits were approved by CMS, we were able to encourage our community practitioners, our specialty physicians, physicians to perform virtual visits, and we made sure that there were enough equipment available. And again, to thank everybody playing their role, we were able to actually get medical grade covering, including tablet devices, through some of the local charities that not only gave us that, but also provided us with some PPE thanks to that. And we are actually, through CMS's information, applying to get some of the CMP money-related audiovisual tablet devices to continue to allow our residents and practitioners to be able to see and talk to their loved ones remotely. The way we are managing our outbreak is we have an APC that evaluates residents on our COVID units at least twice a day, and then presents the update to our command team, the incident command team that I lead as the medical director. Our incident command team consists of the medical director, myself, the executive director or the administrator, the director of nursing, the infection preventionist, and also the in-house advanced practitioner. Through the health of our state department, we were the first facility that or the facilities that were able to test all our resident staff. And to our surprise, we did have around 8% of our staff that tested positive were asymptomatic, and even approximately 3% of our residents were asymptomatic when they tested positive. We use our twice-a-day incident command call to address clinical, operational, HR, regulatory, staffing, and PR and resident family concerns, and we make prompt interventions on clinical management, infection control, testing strategy for upcoming days, as well as staffing changes that might be needed. And it's been an honor to be involved in the decision-making. Medical directors, a lot of time in nursing facilities, don't get that involved, but I am amazed how much the team has come together and respected the medical directors in the buildings with not only clinical, but also administrative recommendations. And I'm proud to say that the first facility, we were able to restrict our outbreak to just two residents with no deaths or hospital sendouts. One of our recovered patients is a hospice patient, and I'm proud to announce as of yesterday that facility is COVID-free using the test-based strategy. We couldn't have done it without the unconditional support from our executive leadership, nursing staff, non-clinical and frontline staff, especially nutrition and environmental services. The family member who did the drive-by on Mother's Day and held "We Love You, Mom" signs in the yard. We have pictures on our website. It's been very heartwarming to see the support that we have received from our practitioners and family members. And last but not the least, I have to thank the State Health Department with their guidance and CMS for their proactive waivers and support in SNF setting, whether it was the three-day stay admission requirement or telehealth waivers. We definitely thank the administrator for the recent letter to the nursing home staff and releasing the recent toolkit. We're still going through it, but it, so far what I've seen is really good. The NHSN reporting is definitely going to be helpful. And I conclude by saying, you know, this is a nasty and a sneaky bug, but together, as we build the plane we fly, we can do it. We are very, very thankful for the financial and the other technical support we received from CMS. And the proposed Nursing Home Commission and the CDC Nursing Home Task Force that we have found out in the last few days are definitely going to be helpful. And I would definitely propose that the practicing physicians be involved in that process, and we work towards probably not having more regulation, but best practices disseminated. And again, thank you very much for CMS staff recommending me to be on this call. It's truly an honor.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mahajan. Really appreciate your perspective, and congratulations to you and your team on your COVID-free facility right now. I'd like to invite my CMS colleagues to ask any questions or share any comments before we open up the lines.
Great. Alina,
operator. This is Marin Couch. I just want to thank them. They're just wonderful stories, and it just means so much for us to hear back from you on what's working. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Operator, let's take some questions from the phone. Thank you.
Certainly. As a reminder to everyone, if you would like to ask a question, just press *1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from Sarish Kapula from CMS. Your line is open.
Sarish Kapula from University of New Mexico. I have a question more for the CMS leaders. We are looking for more guidance with the medical students that we teach. We have received some information on how the residents can kind of document, see the patient, but if we would really appreciate if you can provide more guidance on how we can involve the medical students in these audiovisual visits and also on the billing component of that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your question. We will certainly take that back to our technical and policy experts who are working on those issues.
And just to add, I want to thank for everything that you in CMS have been doing and very timely in this critical time of pandemic. And I would also want more clarity on the facility fee that we can bill for this audiovisual and telephonic visit. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you so much. And I will direct you, we do have a number of technical resources on our website about telehealth. We also recently released a video that kind of is a user guide to the agency's latest guidance on telehealth. So if you haven't seen that yet, I do encourage you to take a look. And again, thank you for joining our call and for asking those questions. Operator, we'll take our next question, please.
Thank you. We have a question from a participant. Please state your first and last name, then ask your question. For the participant with phone number ending with 4156, your line is now open. Please state your first and last name.
Thank you. Kimberly Jamaro. We are beginning to hear that CMS may be planning to amend the visitor restrictions for skilled nursing facilities. Could we have some insight on that, please?
Could you repeat your question, please? I heard you say skilled nursing facilities, but I didn't catch the rest.
We are beginning to hear that CMS may be considering amending the visitor restrictions for skilled nursing centers. I'm wondering if you can provide some insight on that.
Hi, this is Christine Teague from the Division of Nursing Homes. So we, as always, are constantly reevaluating all of our guidance and all of our practices. We are looking at visitations and looking at providing guidance to states and facilities on how to best implement when they are restoring the resident visitations. So as soon as we have information available, we will let you all know.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Thank you. Again, for everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from Sherry Mitchell from Healthcare Council. Your line is open.
Hi. I just, based upon a CMS publication just about an hour ago, just wanted to gain clarification that CMS is planning on publishing the COVID-19 reporting information that goes to the CDC on Nursing Home Compare. And if that is the case, is that going to happen at the end of May, or was that reference to the end of May simply information will be available, but it may not be available on Nursing Home Compare at that time? Thank you.
Christine, would you like to take that question, or we can take this one back as well?
Yes, I can take that question. We will be publishing on the Nursing Home Compare website, but I do not have the exact date yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your question. And thanks again, Dr. Mahajan, for joining us today and for sharing your perspective. And our final segment today is discussing provider resiliency, support, compassion, communications. We know this is a challenging time for providers on the front lines. And joining us today is Dr. Rana Adish, and she is the Director of Pulmonary Hypertension Program and Medical Director of Care Experience at Henry Ford Health System. She's also the author of the book In Shock, which documents her own personal experiences as a patient in the healthcare system. So I'm pleased to turn it over to her. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you to Dr. Schreiber for inviting me to share my experiences today and the experiences of Henry Ford Health System. Henry Ford Health System is an 8-hospital system, with the largest flagship hospital being right in the city of Detroit. And as you all know, Detroit's been quite hard hit by the pandemic. At our peak census, we had over 350 patients just in our hospital that we were treating for respiratory distress related to COVID. And our ICU surged really to double capacity. As the medical director of care experience for the system, I used to have a very unique perspective, having been hospitalized near death in my own system. I'm afraid it's becoming a little more common with this pandemic. We have been very focused on the unique challenges to the delivery of care, not only for our patients, but for our providers. There have been so many issues that arose that really, in many ways, created barriers for our providers to really give an optimal experience of care for the patients, and increased their risk of moral injury. Early in the pandemic, we had the strict visitor restrictions. There was this very critical need to preserve personal protective equipment, and the patients were so isolated that there was really a unique stress of caring for large volumes of critically ill patients in isolation from family, and with a significant risk of contagion for the providers themselves. Communication was made more difficult by those layers of personal protective equipment, and yet it was more important than ever. We found that not having family here meant that the patients were at risk really of depersonalization. We found that many of the patients had the same risk factors of diabetes and hypertension, obesity and OSA, and because of that and the lack of any family nearby and no personal artifacts in the room, it was easy for the patients to blur together to some extent for our nurses and our physicians and respiratory therapists. And this really put them at risk of moral injury. And so we devised early on a leader rounding scheme to allow for regular in-person check-ins with the teams that were caring for COVID patients. We initially cohorted all of our patients in one medical ICU pod that quickly swelled from 16 beds to 150 ICU beds. And it was important early on, before we were able to have results quickly, that the rounder was someone who was already caring for COVID patients. We didn't want to expose additional people to the risk. We felt that it was important that that person be expert in skilled communication and really oriented to the resources that were available. There was so much that was put into place really early on, both from a behavioral health perspective, a wellness perspective, a policy and procedure perspective, but much of that was remote. You know, COVID created a unique situation for all of us in that many of the staff who are normally on site were instead working remotely, and that included our behavioral health colleagues, administrative leaders. And so we really had to make the people who were here able to provide psychological first aid in a way that was meaningful for the people providing the care. And unlike, you know, the sort of mental health interventions that are done by very trained professionals, providing psychological first aid is really something that many people can be trained to do, because it comes down to being visible, available, and validating and normalizing emotions during extreme times, and also recognizing when someone's response may fall outside of what is common or expected. So these psychological first aid wellness rounds were really built to support the staff, and we set out a few goals for ourselves. So the first one was to build connectivity. So simply by having leaders show up, demonstrating support for the work that was being done, and recognizing that it was really in a very complex and evolving situation. So the leaders who rounded were able to share best practice resources that were relevant for the moment. At the beginning, that was simply, how do our nurses decontaminate themselves before going home to young children? It evolved to ensuring that there was adequate PPE. There was a really clear need that people wanted to share their stories. They felt that what they were doing was really extraordinary work in many ways. And we developed, because it was really an ask from the teams that they themselves generated, we developed a site called Frontline Diaries, where anyone in the system could submit photos, diary entries, videos, describing events of their day. And there were questions that were posed that were appreciative inquiry, you know, tell me a moment of compassion that you saw today, as a means of really capturing for ourselves and our colleagues and our leaders who weren't necessarily able to be there with us, who we were and what values we were demonstrating. And it was a very generative process, and it allowed people to have pride in their work and also to share some of the more difficult emotions so that others would feel less alone. Another goal that we set was simply to identify and link to resources. So we had a lot of providers tell the leaders that were rounding that it was incredibly difficult to provide an accurate assessment of how sick families' loved ones had become. Oftentimes our families were dropping patients off at the ER, and they were walking and talking with maybe a fever and some mild respiratory distress, and then they would deteriorate and become ventilated. And describing this became abstract in many ways. And so we heard from the teams that they needed the ability to video conference with families. We helped get about 300 iPads for the units that were caring for these patients, and we set it up with WebEx. IT made that possible. And that allowed not only for the teams to communicate with the families, but also for the families to be brought into the rooms and see their loved ones, and if they were able to communicate, to communicate. And even when they weren't, we had families that would read prayers over the iPad. We had wives that would read letters that they wrote to their husbands. And it was a means of communicating during a time when communication was difficult and people were feeling very isolated. And although that was something that we were doing for the patients, I think the providers benefited in even greater measure, because they were able to have contact visually with the families as they were describing what was very serious news and sometimes having end-of-life conversations. We were also asked to help script a lot of those end-of-life conversations in a compassionate way. We utilized Vital Talk, which is a national organization, to help us to do that. And that scripting was really very gratefully received, especially by our residents, who were often working in unfamiliar areas. And that that brings me to another goal that we set for ourselves of restoring personal integrity. You know, there weren't just physicians who were working in unfamiliar fields and needed to develop a more fluid identity in that space, but there were also a lot of physicians who were sidelined in this crisis, and that was difficult in a different way. We're used to being of use. And so finding ways that those physicians could still find meaning and value and feel a part of this became very important. This was scaled really by teaching coaching behaviors, so teaching leaders to ask reflective questions with non-judgmental curiosity, noticing if the people who they were speaking to needed more support and being really aware of what those resources were. Our chief wellness officer, Lisa McLean, put in a remarkable amount of work creating resources that were available and, although remote, were very accessible. And sometimes it just took someone who was present, rounding, to identify that resource in a one-on-one way for our team members to be able to access them. So I'll stop there and take any questions that anyone might have.
I believe we have a question from one of our colleagues first. Thank you, operator.
Thank you,
Michelle. Thank you, Alina. And it's Michelle Schreiber. What a pleasure to have you on the phone, and what you created within the system in terms of building compassion and reaching out to the providers at a very difficult time for providers as well as patients has been remarkable. I know that there were also some providers who had been in the intensive care unit and who had been very ill. Was there any special approach towards them?
Yes. So we've had a number of our own colleagues who have gotten very sick. And we've actually worked in a number of ways to support them. The most important probably is developing a post-ICU multidisciplinary clinic with behavioral health, physical therapy, pharmacy, and our pulmonary colleagues that are able to provide really comprehensive assessment. You know, there's so much about post-ICU syndrome that we don't understand, and especially for high-functioning people to have the kind of cognitive decline and delirium that many of our patients suffer. It's a tremendous undertaking to rebuild from that. And, you know, I've often wished that when I went through my critical illness, we had something similar. So building that has been a real source of pride for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Other questions or comments from my CMS colleagues before we open it up? Great. Operator, let's take some questions from the phone. Thank you.
Certainly. Everyone, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is *1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from Kif Afet of IHP. Your line is open.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That was very motivating to hear. Just had two questions. One is, you have the contact for Dr. Mahajan just to follow up with him about something?
Sure. I will connect with our speakers at the end of this session to confirm if they'd like to give out any contact information. So you can expect follow-up on that after this call. Thank you.
Okay. It could be an office contact or anything. Okay. And the second follow-up was, again, thank you for having this. Regarding the earlier physician also mentioned, could there be some program in place to help with practices that see pediatric patients and also that are seeing, you know, new patients, no more new patients, you know, right now? Could there be some type of assistance from CMS? Hello?
Hi, Ms. Schreiber. I think we would need to know exactly what you mean by that question and maybe clarify it a little bit more. Are you looking for financial assistance, telehealth assistance? Because I don't know that we have the right people on the phone, but if you could clarify your question, that would be helpful for us.
Okay. like with the current, like the, I think the earlier physician had mentioned, like with the healthcare assistant coverage for Medicare, right, it's usually, it's the one that is there right now is for practices or hospitals that see Medicare patients, which are usually patients that are over 65 years of age. But for practices that see pediatric patients, I guess that didn't include those. So I was wondering if there's some type of assistance that could be, especially for those of us that are seeing patients that don't have insurance or their insurance doesn't cover certain visits. I was wondering if there could be some type of coverage for them.
I understand your question now. Thank you. So there has been conversation about support for those patients who don't just take Medicare. Some of that will be coming through the states. I don't know how much of that has been finalized yet, but just so you know, there are certainly active conversations about that, recognizing that there is a certain percentage of physicians who don't see Medicare.
Okay, so would this be to the State Department of Health?
Alina, do you know where that would come from? Or we could post information on our website.
Yeah, we can post information on that. I've taken down your question, and we can certainly address it either in follow-up communications, or we can also address it at the top of our call next Friday. So thank you so much for your question.
Okay, I appreciate it. And if I wanted to follow up with you, would you be able to send me an email or follow up with you?
Sure. I've taken down your phone number from the call service ending in 0033. So I can send you a follow-up, give you a follow-up phone call at that number. So thank you so much. We'll take our next question, please.
A reminder to everyone, if you would like to ask a question, just press *1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from the line of Suresh Kapoor of CMS. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. We would like to know, like, even for the audiovisual visits, we are still using our MAs and staff to kind of help us set up those visits and also to talk to the patients, get more information, as well as for screening. But we know we don't know how much that kind of activity in the form of facility fee we would get reimbursed. I would need some, I would request some kind of information from CMS about this. Thank you.
So can you please clarify the type of reimbursement clarification you're looking for? Just want to make sure I'm understanding your question correctly.
Thank you. For the right now, we don't know how much of the facility fee we are getting reimbursed for the work the MAs and the other clinical staff are doing, because we are needing a lot more help from them compared to in-person visits, because they are helping us set up the telephone visits for the providers as well as the Zoom or the audiovisual visits we are doing from the clinics. They call the patient, help us get initially before the visit, they actually screen the patient. And then They help us with the social history, family history, and all the components that we need to fill in. So with all the help they are doing, we don't know how much of the reimbursement we are getting from the facility fee component.
Understood. Thank you for the clarification. I don't think we have our correct subject matter experts on the line to address that question, unless any of my physician colleagues would like to take it. Otherwise, we are happy to take that question back and address it either in a follow-up note to you or addressing it at the top of our call next week. So would any of my colleagues like to take that one? Thank you. So we appreciate your question, and again, we will take that one back. Any other questions from folks on the phone today?
Thank you.
For everyone, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no further questions. I'm sorry. We have a question from Kimberly Gamaro of Bowman Health. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. As some of the facilities begin to enter like the mid-range, the post-surge range, we're going to be looking at after-action planning, especially knowing that the fall flu season will be practically right on the heels of this. What types of opportunities do you foresee for centers across the country to do some after-action coordination with CMS regionally or nationally? So these are like operational after-action plans versus political policy after-action plans.
Alina, this is Marion Couch. Thank you for your question. I think we might take that offline and talk. After action plans isn't part of our vernacular, but we're in unprecedented times, so I think it'd be a wonderful conversation. So within the guardrails of what we do at CMS, we'd be happy to talk to you further about that.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, so much for joining our call today, and a special thanks to our guest speakers. It's always really motivating for us here at CMS to hear what providers on the front lines are doing, both in terms of the innovation, the clinical strategies, and just the approaches to these very difficult times. So in the meantime, if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to send to CMS, you can direct those to our COVID-19 email box, which is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. And as always, we appreciate everything that you're doing for patients and their families around the country, and hope everyone gets a restful weekend and take care. Thank you.